Good day, welcome back to Math 3013. So I'll begin today reviewing real quickly what we covered on Monday, and then the intent is to talk more about vectors and introduce two fundamental operations that really are what give linear algebra all its structure. But before I start on the lecture, let me pause and see if there are any outstanding questions before we even begin. I'll also bring up the chat in case people want to type in their questions rather than say them out loud. Okay, well, hearing no questions, let me start. So let's see, where are we? Here we are. So the first thing I want to do is I want to clarify both notationally and conceptually the difference between sets and ordered lists, because that's going to be a crucial distinction throughout the course. So a set is simply a collection of mathematical objects. It could be numbers, it could be equations, it could be vectors or many different sorts of objects, and you simply group them together so you can talk about that collection. We'll use curly braces whenever we're talking about a set of objects. So here, what I've got denoted is a set, three objects. They're separated by commas, just to distinguish the individual items. And then the numbers 1, minus 3, and square root of 2 are the elements of the set I've displayed on the left-hand side here. All right, now distinct from that is the notion of an ordered list, which is a set with actually additional structure. The structure being the order in which the elements appear. So when I denote an ordered list, I'll write it either using parentheses to enclose the objects, or I'll use square braces or square brackets. And either way, both these are equivalent notations for a list of three objects named A, C, and B. And in fact, the order is important. So an object, an ordered list A, B, C is not the same thing as the ordered list B, C, A. Even though they contain the same letters, because their order is different, they would be different ordered lists. All right, so that's, seems to be a small distinction, but it's a crucial distinction in this course, because oftentimes as you write, you might not be careful to distinguish between curly braces and square braces, and these have very different mathematical meaning, at least in applications. When we have, when we write an ordered list, it's very crucial that we maintain that order throughout. Okay, now a vector is a special kind of ordered list. It's an ordered list that consists only of real numbers. So we'll use the square braces when I denote vectors, just as a convention. We could have some textbooks and some courses will also use parentheses rather than square braces to delimit the elements of a vector, but we'll confine ourselves mostly to just using square braces. And the numbers that appear in the ordered list, that will be the dimension of the vector. And the individual numbers that appear, the individual numbers that are ordered in this under this, those are the components of the vectors. And we'll refer to the first number as the first component, the second number as the second component, et cetera. So in this example, square braces minus 5, minus 1, 5, square root of 2 is an order list of three real numbers and hence is a vector. It has three dimensions, it's a three-dimensional vector, and its components are minus 1, 5, and square root of 2. All right, that's just the language I'll be using throughout the course, and I won't be defining it any longer. I'll simply, if I want to refer to a particular component, I'll name it as the first or second or third component of a given vector. All right, now sets, there are two common ways of specifying elements of a set. One is to simply write all the elements down, separated by commas, and enclosing that collection of objects inside curly braces, right? So here's a set that contains two numbers, the square root of 2 and minus the square root of 2. Distinct from this, and actually much more common in this course, is to denote a set, again by curly braces, but instead of explicitly listing the elements, what we do is we give a pattern and then conditions on that pattern. You'll see what I mean in this example. Here, I'm going to redefine the set as a set of elements x, which happen to be real numbers. Remember, this sideways epsilon here is interpreted as saying element of. So x is an element of R, and this symbol for R means the real numbers. So, and this line in the middle, you interpret that as such that. So S is a set of X's that are real numbers such that their square is equal to 2. Well, in fact, in practice, the set I defined in the top line is exactly the same as the set I defined in the bottom line, although they're written differently. The objects are the same. Of course, to see that, you'd have to solve x squared equals 2, that the only solutions of that are square root of 2 and minus the square root of 2. And so this way of stating a set is less precise, maybe, than explicitly listing the elements. But this latter notation is typically how we'll denote sets inside linear algebra, because we'll be looking at sets of objects, and they will often be determined by characteristics rather than by an explicit list. All right, and again, just some remarks in my notation here. If I write what looks to be an equal sign, except it has three lines, then I'm indicating a mathematical definition. I'm telling you exactly what S is, not what S is equal to. Okay, so as I remarked above, I have two different ways of writing down this sit S. I can either explicitly list it, or I can give it via a conditional formulation. You should be comfortable, particularly with the latter in this course. Now, one thing to point out is here I've written the same set two different ways. How do I know it's the same set? How do I test that whatever symbols I've written on the left is equal to the set defined on the symbols I've written on the right? Well, one way to do it is to explicitly list the objects, the elements of the set, and just do a direct comparison one by one. But more generally, and in particular when sets are written in this sort of set notation where a condition is imposed on certain objects, it's not so easy to see, if I had two sets formulated this way, that they were equal. What you have to do to show that sets are equal is to demonstrate two things. First of all, every element of the first set is an element of the second set. And independently, you have to demonstrate that every element of the second set is also an element of the first. If both these conditions hold, then the two sets are equal. So, put another way, two sets are equal if each is a subset of the other. But notice, to check one equality, you have to actually check two different conditions. All right, another sort of set theoretical device that we'll use often here is the notion of a Cartesian product. Here's what it is. A Cartesian product of two sets A and B is going to be denoted as A times B, or A cross B. And what it consists of, it's the set of all ordered pairs, AB. So here I'm indicating an ordered pair by enclosing a list inside parentheses. And that, in addition, that ordered pair, the first element has to be an element of the first set, and the second element B, lowercase b, has to be an element of the second set, capital B. Or in set theoretic notation, the Cartesian product of A and B is the set of pairs, such that the first component lies in A and the second component lies in B. Okay, so with that notation established, now let me introduce further notation, which is going to be the fundamental sets that we use all the time in linear algebra. And they'll be denoted by R, this blackboard bold R is the font, and R superscript N. Now the first one is just a set of all real numbers. The integers, 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 100, 100 million, including negative integers, minus 1, minus 3, rational numbers, 3 quarters, 5 tenths, etc., and the irrational numbers like pi and the square root of 2. All the numbers that you can approximate by decimal numbers on your calculator, and all the numbers that appear in, in terms of measurements in physics or in terms of variables in calculus. All right, and then what I'll mean by R superscript N is the set of all n-dimensional vectors. That being, an n-dimensional vector is a list of n numbers in a particular order. And so here we have it in set theoretic notation. R superscript N is the set of an order list of n objects, where each of those objects is a real number. All right, and these ellipses are used to indicate that this list that was begun with x1, I don't write all the elements down. I can sort of hide them by using ellipses just to indicate that the pattern continues until we reach the last element, xn. Okay, so what this notation is saying is that Rn is a set of ordered list of n objects where each of the objects is a real number. By the way, let me point out that this notation for this n-dimensional vector space Rn mimics its construction using Cartesian products, right? The Cartesian product, what you do to get that, you need to form ordered lists. One element from R ordered with another element of R. So it's exactly a two-element list, and notation-wise, it looks like, indeed, R2 is the real line squared, but it's not squared in the sense of multiplication. It's squared in the sense of this Cartesian product that converts sets into sets of ordered lists of objects. All right, so notice there's a lot of detail hidden in our notation, and it's going to be important to write neatly so that you can actually track the meaning as you're pursuing calculations or even just taking notes. Okay, so that much transpired on Monday. And in fact, on Monday, we also introduced the principal vector space of the course, this general vector space R superscript N, or I'll just call it Rn, the set of all n-dimensional vectors. What we're going to do today is we're going to introduce two fundamental operations on this set that, in fact, are going to give it a much richer structure and, in fact, are going to be the foundation of this course in linear algebra. Okay, so the two operations we'll define are a notion of vector addition and a notion of scalar multiplication. Again, I'm subtly introducing mathematical notation. This is kind of function notation, right? You have a function whose name is plus, and what's it doing? It's going from a set Rn cross Rn. Well, Rn cross Rn is what? It's the set of pairs, because this is a Cartesian product, say AB with A inside the first factor, Rn, and B inside the second factor, Rn. And because this is an element of Rn, it's actually a vector. So let me put arrows over these guys. So you explicitly see that these are pairs of vectors, not pairs of letters. We want to interpret those objects as vectors. And so what vector addition is doing is taking two vectors and it's producing a new vector out of that. Scalar multiplication, on the other hand, is a function that's going to take the set consisting of a number and a vector, and it's converting those objects into vectors, converting that pair of objects into a single vector. All right, so let me define these guys. You've seen these definitions before, but we're going to state them explicitly and concretely. So if I have two n-dimensional vectors, here I'm actually writing them out component by component. And if I want to add them together, what I do is I add them component by component. The first component of the first vector is added to the first component of the second vector to yield the first component of the sum of x plus y. And similar for the remaining components. Right, so vectors add component by component. And here's a sample computation. I don't know if I need to show it in this detail. 1 plus 2 is 3. 3 plus 1, second component is 3 plus 0 is 3. Third component is -1 plus 1 is 0. All right, so it's kind of trivial to add vectors. The second vector operation, fundamental to this course, is the notion of scalar multiplication, wherein you begin with a vector and a number, and you combine them as follows. The scalar multiple of the vector x by the number lambda is the vector. Notice it has n components, so it'll be a vector living in the same space as the original vector, but its components have changed. Now every component of x has been multiplied by the number lambda to get a new number. And the result, being list of n numbers, is the scalar multiple of x by the number lambda. And here's a sample computation. Right? If lambda is equal to negative 2 and x is equal to 1, 3, 2, then lambda times x via scalar multiplication is -2, -6, -4. Okay, all simple enough. Now, here we come to a very crucial point in this course, is that we primarily are going to think about vectors as ordered lists of numbers. That will lead us directly to computations that we can perform. But sometimes to get an intuitive understanding of what our vectors represent, maybe physically or even geometrically, we'll depict them using directed line segments. Now, if I can add, if vectors can be either directed line segments or ordered lists of numbers, how do we go back and forth between these two renditions of what a vector is? Well, first of all, we'll need to understand how we pass from one point of view to the other. So suppose I begin with a geometric vector. Now I'm thinking of a particular instance of a directed line segment. What I want to attach to that is a linear algebraic vector, an ordered list of numbers. So here's how you do that. You take your graphical figure, this directed line segment, you put a coordinate system on it so that the origin of the coordinate system is right at the base or the starting point of that directed line segment. And then you use a ruler to demarcate some units along the coordinate axes. And then with that figure drawn out, you simply identify the coordinates of the tip of the arrow of that directed line segment with respect to the origin that you prescribed at the base of the directed line segment. And then what happens is the coordinates of that tip will be a pair of numbers, and you interpret that as the ordered list of numbers corresponding to this geometric vector. You can go the opposite way as well. If I had started with an ordered list 3, 2, then I could construct the geometric vector corresponding to this ordered list by simply inserting a coordinate system with the and then drawing an arrow that starts at the origin and goes to the point with coordinates 3, 2. And then I erase the coordinate system and I'm left with a directed line segment. And that's the geometric vector that corresponds to the linear algebraic vector 3, 2. All right, now, we're not gonna do much of this translation so much, but it's gonna be important in the next couple of slides so you see how a geometric picture of what those fundamental vector operations would be. But let's start with adding vectors. We know how to add them as lists of numbers, like 1, 2 plus 2, 1 is going to equal 3, 3, right? We know how to add vectors when they're interpreted as lists of numbers. How do we add vectors when we interpret them as geometric line segments or directed line segments? Well, if you have a vector, what we're really focusing on are its length and its direction. That's what's really characterizing this directed line segment. It doesn't matter where on the page I put it, as long as it has the same length and the same direction, I regard it as the same vector. This is the data that's actually determining the vector. So the way we add vectors is we use the freedom to move an individual vector around on our piece of paper. It's moving in such a way that we never change its length or its direction. We call this parallel transport. I can move it around the various positions on the page. It still represents the same geometric vector. And so I add vectors as follows. If I have two vectors drawn on a piece of paper, I take the second one and I move it around on the piece of paper until its base is at the tip of the first vector. And then what I do is I draw a line that starts at the base of the first vector and ends up at the tip of the second vector. Then I erase the two summing vectors and I'm left with a single vector. And that's geometrically how I add vectors. I move them around, get them adjacent to one another, draw a line that sort of gives them the, if you think of these as displacements, what this vector sum represents is the total displacement, where I go from this point to this point, and then I go in the direction of the second vector, the length of that second vector. And that's how we add vectors geometrically. Note that I don't have to do any calculations in doing this. All I need is a ruler to make sure I'm maintaining the length and a protractor to make sure I'm keeping the angles the same as I move these vectors around on a piece of paper. So it's a completely different computation than our addition of vectors when we think of them as ordered lists of numbers. Now that's a very important point in this course, because what we're eventually going to see, even in today's lecture, is what really distinguishes vectors is not the objects, ordered lists of numbers or directed line segment. What really characterizes vectors are the operations that we perform on them. All right, so let's do the second operation geometrically. If I have a number, lambda, and a directed line segment, then its scalar multiple is, developed as follows. When I multiply a geometric vector, a directed line segment, by a number, I just rescale its length. Well, that's true if it's a positive number. If I multiply a directed line segment such as this times 2, then what happens is I get a vector that goes in the same direction, but it's going to be twice as long. So what multiplication, scalar multiplication by a positive number does is it simply rescales the length of the vector. If I multiply by 1/2, what would happen is I'd get a vector that had half the length of the original vector. Okay, now, we multiply vectors by any real number. So I've told you what happens when we multiply by a positive number. What happens when we multiply by a negative number is similar, but there's one additional effect coming from the minus sign of a negative number. That multiplication by minus 1, it has the effect of reversing the direction of a vector. So if this is a vector A, then minus A is going to be a vector that basically has the same direction, except it has the opposite orientation. You move the arrowhead from the tip to the tail, and that will be the negative of the vector. And so the rule for doing scalar multiplication of geometric vectors is to use the magnitude of the scalar multiple to adjust the length of the vector. And if there's a minus sign, or if lambda is a negative number, then you also have to remember that not only is the length is going to change, but also its direction is going to be reversed. Okay, and so here I give an example, minus 2 times 2, 1 as being minus 2. Sorry, this is a typo. That should have been minus 4, minus 2. Let me correct that typo. Minus 2 times the vector with components 2, 1 is going to be minus 4, minus 2. All right, that's using the rule for order lists of numbers. And what I want to show you, what happens geometrically, if I take this vector who, and I view it geometrically as a directed line segment, and I also represent the result of multiplying 2, 1 by minus 2 as a directed line segment in the second picture, you see what happened is that this directed line segment doubled in length, but reversed in sign. And so these two methods of adding vectors, one adding ordered lists, the other adding directed line segments, they're compatible with one another. All right, so we evidently have two different ways of thinking about vectors. In this course, we're gonna, as I've sort of been hinting at it all along, we're gonna concentrate on thinking of linear vectors as ordered lists of numbers, because that will be, as soon as we represent them that way, they'll be directly calculable. But there are other reasons for confining ourselves to ordered lists of numbers. First of all, geometric vectors, I can only really draw on a piece of paper. If I had a three-dimensional vector, you can sort of render it if you have appropriate software as a 3D image, but you can't really draw it on a piece of paper. And if you look at higher dimensional vectors, like a four-dimensional vector or a 10-dimensional vector, there's actually no way to actually draw those directed line segments. So just to deal with vectors in a more general setting than simply a three-dimensional space, we have to consider vectors as order lists of numbers rather than as geometric objects. Even though in some abstract sense, a 10-dimensional vector is going to exist as a geometric object in a 10-dimensional space, our problem is that we can't visualize that 10-dimensional space. And so the geometric intuition that would come from thinking of vectors as directed line segments really isn't going to help us in that case. All right, and then the other nice thing is that when we work with order lists of numbers, we more or less treat every vector, whether it's a two-dimensional vector or a 10-dimensional vector, we use the same algorithms and computational methods. Okay, so I mentioned in the first class that there are other ways of thinking about vectors, typically coming from physics and engineering, where they represent physical quantities that have a certain magnitude and direction. And when we think about physical vectors, we still have, still going to have the two basic operations. Scalar multiplication, for example, can be interpreted as changing the units of measurement. So if you, a vector that's 1 foot long would be a vector that's what, 12 inches long. So you can think of it, but converted to numbers, it's going, it's either a length 3 or a length 12. But let me give you a more obtuse example of what a physical vector would be, just to demonstrate the importance of those fundamental operations in identifying what about the set makes it a vector. So the example I want to consider is air pressure fluctuations or sound waves. My claim is that these can be thought of as vectors, but what you should note is it's hard to see the direction of a sound wave you may think of the direction in which it propagates, but it may be propagating, you know, in a bunch of directions. So it's just, you hit a drum in the middle of a park, it's propagating in all directions. So you're not going to get a direction so easily from a sound wave, at least not specifically. And nor do you actually see the components of a vector of a sound wave either. Not unless you analyze it in a particular way. And so to see how sound waves can be thought as vectors, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to look at the individual sound waves and try to ascribe to them a direction and magnitude or an ordered list of numbers. Rather, I'm going to show you how you can operate on this set of sound waves, and they behave like vectors. In what sense? Well, you can add sounds. When you listen to an orchestra, you hear the trumpets, you hear the violins, you actually hear the individual flutes. And so just as the orchestra combines the sound of the individual instruments, so you can add sounds as vectors. And that's what we'll think of as the analog of adding vectors. We'll add sounds by essentially playing them at the same time. You can also scale and multiply sound waves, but it's not going to change the length of the sound wave. Rather, what it's going to change is the amplitude of the corresponding vibration. So we're talking about a physical sound wave. Well, that corresponds to pressure fluctuations inside a given room, for example. And when we scale and multiply a sound wave by a positive number, what if that is to correspond to is either increasing the amplitude or decreasing the amplitude by a certain scaling factor, which will correspond to the number lambda. All right, so essentially scale and multiplication corresponds to making the sound louder or softer. Well, that's scale and multiplication by a positive number. What about by a negative number? Well, to describe that, it may seem weird at first, but it's actually a crucial application of this thinking of sound waves as vectors. Let's be right here. This is some pressure fluctuation, so a sound wave. Here we'll have time going this way. And so as time goes on, the displacement from some equilibrium pressure we'll put in the center. And what the sound wave is, it's fluctuations, so it's deviations from this equilibrium pressure. Now, so this is kind of a graphical picture of what a sound wave is. What's scalar, let's call that A. What a sound wave minus A would be is it's going to be another pressure fluctuation. But what you do to get it is you simply flip the places where the pressure is high, you flip that down to where places where the pressure is low. You just reflect across this equilibrium position. And so we call this, or this is this, we'll call this reversing the phase of a vibration. And that's exactly how scalar multiplication by minus one, how it acts on sound waves. And of course, that actually has a crucial, but maybe not obvious, application. If you have noise-canceling headphones, the way they work is you have external noise coming in, hitting your headphones, and then there's also a microphone here that will pick up this external signal and it will invert it. So if it was actually like this, it would create its own internal signal where that oscillation has been reversed. And then you also have the signal coming from your computer or your cell phone or whatever here. The problem is, without the noise cancellation, you get the external noise combined with the internal noise. But when you combine all three inputs, the signal from your cell phone, the external noise, and the inverse of the cell noise, what happens when you combine these three noise in your ears, these two end up canceling, and you get the pure signal from your audio device. And so this abstract way of regarding sound pressure violations as vectors actually makes good physical sense. We have operations that we can perform on sound waves that are going to mimic operations we perform on directed line segments or ordered lists of numbers. And in fact, the proper way to think about a vector is not as a directed line segment, not as a ordered list of numbers, not as a sound wave, but rather this abstract thing, in the same sense that the number three can be thought of either as a symbol, a set of three objects, right? We just list three items, and you can think this is another version of the number three, or I can hold up three fingers, I can show you three pins. Those are all instances of the number three, and in the same sense, sound waves, geometric figures like directed line segments or ordered lists of numbers, those are all different renditions of the single abstract idea of what a vector is. Okay, so let's see. The next thing I want to consider, having introduced our two basic fundamental operations, is to now combine them. And so every time we add vectors, we get another vector. Every time we scale and multiply vectors, we get another vector. And those results, we can actually combine further, add them and multiply them by scalar numbers. And so this leads to more general constructions where we combine scalar multiplication and vector addition. We call such multiple combinations where we use both operations, scalar multiplication and vector addition, we call such combinations linear combinations. And more generally, instead of just combining two vectors and two numbers in this fashion, we can take a collection of n vectors, and we can take another collection of n numbers, and we can combine them all together to produce a single vector. And that's what's represented here. The way I calculate it is I scalar multiply each of these vectors, v1 through vn, by a corresponding number, lambda 1 through lambda n, and then I add those results up to get a single vector. We call that construction taking a linear combination of the list of n given vectors. All right, one example of a linear combination that occurs quite frequently, particularly in applications, is what you would otherwise know as vector subtraction. So I'm going to define it using our basic operations, vector addition and scalar multiplication. So what I mean when I say A minus B as vectors is I'm going to want to add to A the scalar multiple of the vector B by minus one. So the left-hand side is what I'm defining, and on the right-hand side, note that I've defined it in terms of our two basic operations, only vector addition and scalar multiplication. But this arises quite frequently in application because what vector subtraction represents, at least geometrically, is the displacement between two vectors. So here's a geometric picture of the situation. A minus the vector B is the vector that goes from the tip of B to the tip of A when A and B share a common origin. Let me show you graphically how that actually works. So if we think of A as this vector and B as corresponding to this directed line segment, then, from scalar multiplication, minus B is going to equal vector of the same length, but in the opposite direction. And A plus minus one, so think of this as minus one times B, is going to be, well, here's our rule. We write the first vector, and then we add, then we take the second vector, and we move it so that its base is at the tip of the other vector, and we get this. Okay, now, here's a vector. It's not quite, if you look back to my the screen share here, the way I wrote the vector a minus b here, this is also a minus b, it looks like it's on a different triangle rather than the one that's depicted on screen. But I can take this vector and I can move it over here. And now remember, this is minus b up top. B would be a vector in this direction here. And so this a minus b, all I did was parallel transport it over to this position. And now you see, this is in the center is a, this is b, this is minus b, this is a minus b, using our two rules for scalar multiplying and adding geometric vectors. And then this is a simpler way to draw it. You just, once you've written down your two vectors, you just go from the base of the second, tip of the second vector to the tip of the first vector to add these two vectors, a and b. Okay, so, another thing I guess I should mention, that's very important, it is important that the number zero is to algebra, is the zero vector. It's the unique vector in whatever vector space it's living in that can, for which all the components are equal to zero. So I'll typically write it when I'm writing by hand, it's a zero with an arrow above it. And it's just going to be a vector for which all components are equal to zero. The number of zeros I put in here is going to depend on the vector space in which this lives. So if this vector lives inside Rn, then what I'm going to write down is an ordered list of n zeros. All right, and like the number zero, it allows us to perform some simple tests. If I want to know if two vectors are equal, it suffices to make sure that their difference is equal to zero. And so two vectors are equal only if their difference is zeros. The same is true for numbers. But notice that on my, whether I'm writing things on a piece of paper or I'm typesetting things on these slides, that I'm trying to distinguish between when I write a symbol A and I want to interpret it as a vector, I'm using a boldface font on screen, and I'm putting arrows over symbols when I write them on a piece of paper. That's because there's so much similarity between adding numbers and adding vectors, at least notationally, that it could be confusing as to what we're doing in any particular stage of a calculation. You have to know what you're adding before you add them, because numbers add differently than vectors. So be aware of that. Linear algebra is going to look a lot, notation-wise, the operations that we perform and how we indicate the operation, it's going to look a lot like regular algebra. But you have to be aware of what you're adding and what you're scalar multiplicating, in general, what you're combining together. So what I'll try to do is I'll indicate that notationally by ornating these objects a little bit. When I'm writing on paper, I'll put little arrows over vectors. When I'm writing on screen, I'll try to use a boldface font to indicate a certain symbol represents a vector rather than a number. You should do the same, because it will keep your thinking straight. You'll be in the middle of the calculation, you've got to add these things together. Well, to proceed calculationally, you're going to have to know which rule you apply. And for that, you're going to have to know what kind of objects you're dealing with explicitly. Not the symbols that represent the object, you're going to have to actually know that this vector here is indeed an ordered list of numbers, not simply a symbol. Okay, so I guess this is as far as I got in my first lecture today, and so I'm going to stop here today. What we're going to do on Friday is we'll finally start to get into some material that may be genuinely fresh for many of you. Many of you that have seen matrices before, but on Friday we're going to introduce matrices as the last really fundamental object for consideration in this course, and the last sort of basic object that we'll calculate with. And so I'll introduce that on Friday, not by fundamental definitions as I did for vectors, as ordered lists of numbers, but rather I'll show you how matrices arrived as soon as you tried to solve a system of linear equations in any generality. And then we'll use that to generalize the idea of the matrices and essentially we will come to think of matrices as actually being a generalization of the notion of vectors. In fact, I'll state it now. A matrix, well, if a vector is an ordered list of numbers, then you can think of a matrix as an ordered list of vectors. And then I'll make sense of that better on Friday. But I'll stop here and pause for questions. Okay, hearing none, then I guess I will dismiss class, and I will see you again on Friday.